This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. It's time for Law and Behold, our ongoing series aimed at improving constitutional literacy among Malaysians, done in collaboration with the Malaysian Bar and the University of Malaya's Faculty of Law. So today we're looking at issues linked to our federal constitution that have been making the headlines over the past couple of weeks. So first, we're going to touch on free speech while discussing how YB Xavier Jayakumar is being investigated under the Sedition Act and the Communications and Multimedia Act. Then we're going to discuss the importance of parliamentary oversight as envisioned in the Constitution with regard to the recent stimulus packages announced. And finally, we're going to look at the role of the Attorney General of Malaysia, whose responsibilities are provided for in the federal Constitution. And joining me to help unpack all of these is Datuk Malik Imtiaz Sawa, a lawyer practicing constitutional law. Welcome, Imtiaz. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you so much for joining us. So just to get straight into it, Imtiaz, so last week there was a statement released by Bukit Aman, and that stated that politician Dr. Xavier Jayakumar is being investigated under the Sedition Act and Section 233(1) of the Communications and Multimedia Act. And this is, of course, over his remarks that the recent Dewan Rakyat sitting would be, quote-unquote, worthless and rubbish. So, you know, for those who are unfamiliar, could you perhaps explain those two acts and, you know, why many consider it quite oppressive legislation that is, you know, somewhat harmful to the right to free speech?
Well, you know, the Sedition Act is quite notorious. I think a lot of us know it as the law that's often used to quell any legitimate dissent. At least that was how it was done historically. And it was so notorious that the Pakatan Harapan promised to have it repealed. And largely the complaints about the use of that law was that the term sedition was so ambiguous and broadly defined that it could be used almost elastically to restrict what could otherwise be legitimate dissent or expression. The multimedia provision is also problematic. Like in other jurisdictions which had this provision when the laws were first established, but over time, like in India, those provisions have been narrowed down considerably. That act has a general provision which allows for the MCMC to intervene with also there being possible criminal charges if there were, loosely put, offensive publications online. So, I mean, this is an unfortunate provision, I think, and it's something that a lot of us have always felt needed to be narrowed down considerably because, again, like the Sedition Act, there's a certain element of subjectivity as to what is offensive and what is not. No real criteria by which you can measure what is offensive or not. And that, of course, becomes problematic, especially when it's used, as some perceive, for political purpose. So those provisions are obviously problematic. And I mean, historically, in the run-up to the May 2018 general elections, we saw the Sedition Act being used quite extensively. Again, I remember the bar taking a very strong position against the various charges that have been preferred against various individuals, some of whom were not even politically active as members of political parties. I remember Azmi Sharung having been charged, that case ultimately withdrawn. Haris Ibrahim being charged, that case was also ultimately it hasn't been withdrawn. The appeal was ultimately consented to by the state. But so clearly controversial provisions and clearly something that will give a lot of people some sense of disquietude because it seems to harken back to an earlier era when, you know, free speech was being compromised to further political ends.
Mm-hmm. And it is a pre-independence legislation, isn't it? It's, you know, really rather outdated.
So the Sedition Act is actually pre-Malaya, and that's something that we had argued in Azmi Sharum's case in the federal court, because our constitution says only parliament has the power to restrict free expression, and that's on grounds of public order, public morality, amongst other things. And there's a legal process by which that has to happen, and there are certain safeguards that have been built in. So the question for us was always, how could we now accept a pre Malaya law that was actually put in place to suppress the freedom movement as an expression of parliamentary power. It wasn't. But unfortunately, the federal court in that case took the view that it survived the independence of Malaya and later Malaysia and is still in force, which is why the Pakatan Harapan felt that they should see to repealing it. Yeah. But, you know, it's not something that can be approached definitively, whether or not we need laws like the Sedition Act. I think the starting point is a lot of us do recognize that there's a need for some law to prevent hate speech. Mm-hmm. Then hate speech obviously needs to be defined objectively. And it could be that in the Malaysian context, because, you know, all laws have to take on some context from the countries in which they are brought into being and enforced. So clearly here, issues like the role of the sultans and the special rights of the Malays, those issues might potentially be sensitive. And as we've seen historically in 69, the you know, income disparities led to the rights. At least that's the popular version of that of history. So, you know, I think there's an argument to be made that we still do need some laws to ensure that certain boundaries are respected and things don't go overboard. But my view is that, you know, instead of defining it by specific reference to ethnicity or to sovereignty or otherwise, we should be looking at those kinds of things that we think could objectively be viewed as hate speech and then look to finding ways to curtail it. And that's what I understood was meant to happen in the last government's term. And I'm not sure where things have gone with that effort. So just to round it off, I think that, yeah, we shouldn't be, I think, as a modern country, we shouldn't be relying on antiquated legislation aimed for one purpose to achieve a different purpose. And I think we should be bold enough to understand what it is that makes us who we are in this country, recognize that there's a need for active discussion on matters pertaining to government and democracy in the wider sense, and then ask ourselves what is it that we think would impinge on that, and then limit our restrictions to that, and then police those restrictions. And that's the same approach I think that the MCMC should be taking consistently when dealing with publications online. So the Sedition Act definitely, I think, has to go. But hate speech laws, I think, are an essential thing for us moving forward.
And, you know, as you noted, and many others have also noted, you know, with some irony, that the Pakatan Harapan government did not repeal the act as they promised in their election manifesto. But some are calling for the Perikatan Nasional to repeal these laws. Of course, they are not bound by any manifesto as such. But do you see something like that potentially happening?
Forgive me for being skeptical, because, you know, when you have ethnopolitics, the way the Perikatan operates, and the basis of its, you know, coalition, I doubt very much that attempts are going to be made to deal with the more distressing parts of that act. And the fact that the government seems quite content to allow for investigations under this Sedition Act, it seems to indicate that, you know, as far as Perikatan is concerned, it's there's really no concern with that act. You know, and it was, in fact, enforced when we had the Barisan government before the Pakatan Harapan, and a number of the political parties that are now in Perikatan. So I'm not hopeful. I think it should be looked at, but I think the political ideologies of the Perikatan might make that difficult.
All right. So speaking of Parliament and Perikatan, I mean, another thing that was making the headlines, of course, was the one-day sitting of the Dewan Rakyat. So, you know, we saw the Yang Di-Pertuan Agong delivering his royal address, but that, of course, was followed by no debates whatsoever after. So the one-day sitting of Dewan Rakyat was actually in accordance of Article 55.1 of the Federal Constitution. Am I correct?
Well, I mean, the fact of it, Article 55.1 requires there to be a sitting of Parliament every so often. So in that sense, yes, there was a fulfillment of that provision in the letter of it. Mm-hmm. But I guess really a lot of people have is, you know, can you just summon Parliament and then not do anything and say that you've fulfilled that provision? And obviously then you'll have the lawyers who say that, you know, you're allowed to take a literal view of the Constitution, and then there'll be those who'll say that you have to take a dynamic, purposive approach to the Constitution. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of debate about that. So I think, to put it bluntly, if the question is, did the government comply with the Constitution insofar as the requirements of Article 55.1 is concerned, I would say on its face, yes. Mm-hmm. Parliament was summoned, a sitting was held, and then it was deferred. And it was held in a way that some will say was made possible by the standing orders themselves. So again, on the face of it, that, you know, leave aside the question of political maneuvering, was this an outcome that could be achieved legitimately? I think, as distressing as it may seem, I think there's an argument that it could have been legitimate. Because ultimately, you must remember that the Speaker controlled the chamber.
Mm.
And the Speaker had felt that there was something that was not correct, then perhaps the Speaker should have said so. My view is that I don't think the proceedings were run in the manner that the standing orders required, because there's a list of things that have to happen every time Parliament is summoned. And yes, the government can dictate government business, and it was up to the government that day to say that we do not wish for government business to be tabled today. Mm-hmm. So the three bills that initially intended to be tabled were not. But I don't know whether they could go so far as to say or dictate that there should be no debate on the King's speech. That is something I think should have been taken up as a motion in the House, and in my view should have been made the subject of some debate or at least a vote to allow the Speaker to form a view on what needed to be done. So I'm not entirely sure the Speaker could have made a preemptive determination in the way it seems to have been done here. I can't say for sure that's what he did. But looking at what was in the media, it seems to me that he had made a preemptive determination. So that, to me, is a bit problematic. But in theory, if everything had been done as required by law, then I would say that, as distressing or as frustrating as it may be, the proceedings were valid. Now, whether that those proceedings were then useful is a whole different question.
That's right.
And then, sure, one could say that the proceedings were really of no use. Because what purpose did they serve other than to ensure that there was no violation of the Constitution? And I think the government has pretty much stated that that was the intention. Of course, what's rankling is the reliance on the pandemic to justify the one-day sitting. It's not even a one-day sitting. It was, what was it, an hour?
Yeah, something an hour. Like that, yeah.
So that also obviously rankles, because given that, you know, the economy had been, well, reopened to a large extent, that government was still functioning, and if ministers can go to Putrajaya and work, and we see all these videos and photos of them online doing their work, or seemingly doing their work, then it raises the question of why is it that Parliament can't sit? And that I think is the most fundamental question, because ultimately the source of all power is the Constitution, but then Parliament shapes the government, because majority confidence in Parliament dictates who it is that forms the government. So in that way, you could say that Parliament was actually the source of the government's power. And if the government can sit, then surely the source of that power should be able to sit as well. That's my view. But as I said, there are two sides to it.
That's right. But one of the issues, or, you know, something that MPs from the current opposition brought up was, you know, the fiscal stimulus packages that were announced by the government at the end of April. You know, that's largely been implemented. And, you know, while it's acknowledged that the government needed to act quickly, you know, so many have raised concerns over the lack of parliamentary oversight in the process. Am I correct in saying that the federal constitution envisions the parliament to provide a check and balance mechanism to the use of financial resources by the executive?
Yes, that's very clear to me. Parliament is not just to provide a means of calling government to account and to pass law. One of the critical functions of Parliament is to ensure legislative oversight over matters of finance. Mm. And that's very, very clear. There are various provisions in the Constitution, a whole section that's devoted to just that. Because ultimately, all monies are meant to go into the consolidated fund of the country. And then if monies are going to be charged on that fund, it can only be done by virtue of what the Constitution allows. So, I mean, one argument is that you could that this government could always ratify whatever it's done. So say the fiscal package. Mm-hmm. But the difficulty with ratification is, what if people disagreed? And how do you then unwind what happened? So, and if there was no ratification of those stimulus packages, which will be required, when I say ratification, I mean post-event. You do it first and then seek the authority for it from Parliament. What if Parliament says no? What do you do? Now, on the one hand, that would be a vote of no confidence.
Okay.
But on the other hand, how do you deal with the financial implications of unauthorized expenditure? You see, so to put it plainly, I don't think government can, on its own, use the finances of the country for purposes that it considers independently of Parliament to be relevant or necessary for the interests of the country. I don't think the government has that power under the Constitution. In taking that step, I think the government did take a very, very risky, adopted a very risky course, which may become problematic when Parliament is allowed to reconvene to debate these things with wide ramifications, which is why, you know, if you consider what Singapore is doing in the same time frame, their stimulus packages keep on, were matters that they took back to Parliament regularly. So there are several bills that were passed to allow for those steps to be taken. Similarly, in England, steps were taken in Parliament, which is why a lot of people were saying, what was the big deal with allowing Parliament to just function? It would have given the government the protection it should have in making these sorts of decisions, even if those decisions were required, you know, urgently or in the public interest. And I think the government should have maybe had faith in Parliament to make the right decisions. I mean, this pandemic has been, I think, a uniting episode in our life. We may disagree on measures that were taken, but fundamentally all of us, I think, accept that things had to be done. And of course, things amongst the things that had to be done were stimulus packages. So there would have been bipartisan support of this, I would think. Yeah, so I mean, coming back to your question, yes, parliamentary oversight was essential and is essential, is required by the Constitution. And I'm hard-pressed to come up with a legal justification to support what was done here, other than to say that there can be an attempt to try and get ratification, but that may not work out, which then raises the question of what happens then.
Because, I mean, another question is, you know, with the lockdown of Parliament, you know, the suspension of parliamentary oversight and scrutiny, I think, until July, you know, and to who is the cabinet actually collectively responsible to?
Absolutely. So, you know, in the constitutional framework, the only time that Parliament is suspended is when there is a declaration of emergency. Mm. And then what we have is the king becoming the head of our government. And in that limited situation, in that exceptional circumstance, is entitled to perform legislative function. So, you know, like May 1369, certain things were done, emergency was declared, and then certain emergency ordinances were made. And that's perfectly valid within the context of an emergency. But even in an emergency, the expectation is that Parliament will reconvene as soon as possible, which is why even though the emergency declarations went on till 2011, when Najib Razak then revoked them, mm-hmm. Parliament was functioning in that period. So technically we were under emergency, but Parliament was functioning. So other than that, there is really no provision in the Constitution that allows for the suspension of Parliament, other than where the Speaker himself feels that Parliament should be suspended for reasons that he can look at. In the usual course, we would see the Speaker exercising powers of suspension where he gets so fed up with everybody shouting at everyone and there's no order in the chamber. He says, all right, I'm suspending Parliament till the afternoon or until tomorrow. Okay, that's normal. So, which is why I think that and I come back to it, I'm a bit hard-pressed to find a legal justification for what's been done. And that takes us back to possibly what, you know, some of the sentiments are, is that you're just fulfilling Article 55(1), you know, in letter and not in spirit. So then, you know, as you've probably heard this, there's black letter law, and then there's the whole underlying intent of the provision. So clearly the intent of Article 55.1 is to have Parliament reconvene at the very most every 6 months so that there can be oversight. It's not intended to just perform a rubber stamping function, if in fact that's what happened here. I can't say that because nothing was done other than the speech of the King. But, you know, given that we had a new government, the King's speech was important because traditionally the King's speech, as it is in England, is used to lay out the vision of the government. And then Parliament will debate whether that's a sustainable vision or it's a vision that they can put it can put its weight behind, or whether that vision should be tweaked, whatever. So I would have thought that, you know, given the pandemic, that speech should have been about everything that's going to be happening, the new normal, and how we're going to be dealing with this the next few years. And one would have thought that that would have been a priority for Parliament. So I'm essentially going back to the same issue. And yes, I think parliamentary oversight is critical. And it should be put in place as soon as possible. You know, I think the government should consider getting Parliament to reconvene earlier if it can. It doesn't have to wait till July. And I think political issues aside, there is great security in Parliament making the decisions, and no one can be faulted. Yeah,
that's right. I'm speaking today to Datuk Malik Imtiaz-Sawa. He is a lawyer practicing constitutional law, and we are looking at various issues concerning our federal constitution that have made the headlines over the past couple of weeks. We've touched on free speech and also on parliamentary oversight. And coming up after this quick break, we're going to talk about the role of the Attorney General of Malaysia. So do stay tuned. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs, and joining me on the line today is Datuk Malik Imtiaz-Sawa. He is a lawyer practicing constitutional law, and he is joining us for our Law and Behold series, and we are going through some headlines that that are linked to our federal constitution that have been making the headlines over the past couple of weeks. So just before the break, Imtiaz spoke about free speech and also about parliamentary oversight, but now we are going to talk about the Attorney General of Malaysia and sort of do a 101 on his role. So, I mean, Imtiaz, you know, the AG was making the headlines, or the role of the AG was making the headlines these past couple of weeks. You know, first, of course, there was the controversy surrounding the decision to discharge film producer Riza Aziz over money laundering charges. It was a discharge not amounting to an acquittal, of course. And then, of course, came the controversy where the current AG said that the decision was based on something that the former AG had agreed to in principle in terms of the settlement. The MACC also said that, but then former AG Tan Sri Tommy Thomas, of course, came out and vehemently denied that he had agreed to the settlement. Now, all that aside, what we wanted to look at today was the role of the AG in Malaysia. So am I correct that the position and role of the AG is enshrined in the Federal Constitution of Malaysia?
Yes, it is. It's Article 145 of the Constitution. And essentially, the AG serves or carries out two different functions. One is he is the legal advisor to the government. Mm-hmm. And the other is he is also the public prosecutor, which means he is in charge of the criminal justice system insofar as prosecutions is concerned.
And how is the AG both appointed and removed from the role under the Constitution?
Okay, so the Attorney General does not have security of tenure under the Constitution. Mm. Now, this has always been something of a problem for those of us who follow these subjects. So a judge has security of tenure. It means that a judge cannot be removed unless Parliament decides that he or she should be removed. And that would require an inquiry by a committee of Parliament. And the only instance we've had in history is Tun Salih Abbas' removal. Mm. Okay, so that's what we mean when we say someone has security of tenure. Other than that, that person cannot be removed. Now, the Auditor General of the country also has security of tenure, as I understand it, and so does the Election Commission Chair, and I think the members of the Commission. But curiously, the Attorney General does not. Now, if the Attorney General was purely the legal advisor of the government, then I could understand that security of tenure was not essential, because the whole purpose of security is to ensure objectivity and independence. If someone was worrying about whether he or she was going to be removed as a judge or as a public official, he or she might subconsciously be induced into making decisions that aren't entirely objective. And, you know, subconscious bias is always a problem for public officials, and it's recognized even judges suffer under the possibility of subconscious bias. So it's legally recognized as being a reality. But for some strange reason, the Attorney General, who is also the public prosecutor, does not have security of tenure. Now, what this means then is, according to the Constitution, he holds office at the pleasure of His Majesty, the King. What that means is it's a dressed up way of saying that, in effect, he's a civil servant, because that is the term used normally for civil servants. The King obviously has to act on advice. He's compelled to act on advice by the Constitution. And so the advice by the PM or cabinet to either appoint or to remove it is material. And so we saw some of that in the removal of Tan Sri Gani Patel.
Mm-hmm. 2015, right?
Yes, by the former Prime Minister Najib Razak. And of course, the question was asked as to whether or not, you know, but it was never pursued, whether a prime minister who was the subject of investigation could correctly give that advice, because there's obviously a conflict of interest on the face of it. But putting that aside for a minute, it means that the Attorney General can be removed if the government of the day feels that he should be, and advises the King to make that direction to remove. So that's how the Attorney General is hired and colloquially fired.
And okay, and you know, so I mean, just to kind of summarize, you know, since the AG's main role is as the legal advisor of the government of the day, so following that, the Prime Minister does, you know, technically does have the power to replace him as such, right?
Yes, but we need to make one. I need to just clarify one thing. You see, like in England, the Attorney General is also a political appointee, and if I'm not mistaken, can even be a member of cabinet. And I think that's something that our constitution does allow for as well. Historically, it's not been done in recent times. But the important thing to note is our constitution does have, we have a written constitution that creates the office of the Attorney General and then lays out certain things that he's supposed to be doing for the Federation. And that's interesting, because when you have a written constitution creating that office, it could be said, and I think it applies here, that that office is therefore under certain constitutional duties. Mm. And that necessarily imports the element of fairness and objectivity and so on. So this is a little bit different from, say, the situation in England, where there is no written constitution and you have conventions as to how things should be done. So when I say he's the Attorney General is the advisor of the government, this does not mean, as I understand it, that the Attorney General should be free to act just as a lawyer would for his own client. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. And if I could just take that example, you know, in litigation, lawyers will always try to make sure their client succeeds. And, you know, there's a thin line between what is acceptable practice and what is sharp practice. And the morality of the law doesn't necessarily figure in the decisions that are made when one advises one's client. I don't think the Attorney General necessarily fits into that sort of description of a lawyer. He has constitutional function and constitutional duty that goes beyond this. And one of the things we hear quite commonly is the Attorney General saying, not this current AG, but previously, the AG says he's the guardian of the Constitution. I think that's correct. So yes, he does advise, but the advice must be consistent with the Constitution. And so when he acts as the advisor to the King, to the government, he gives advice accordingly. Similarly, if he's acting in his role as public prosecutor, then he is duty bound to ensure independence and objectivity and all the rest of it.
But, you know, there are some problems or issues, you know, that have been highlighted surrounding the position of the Attorney General. For example, Article 1453 provides wide discretionary powers to the AG that, you know, could perhaps be open to abuse. Is that correct?
Yes. I think that's correct, because, you know, the power to charge or not charge someone for a crime around 1MDB, well, in and around the 1MDB affair, attempts were made in court to try and get some sort of clarification as to whether or not it was appropriate to discontinue proceedings or not even bring proceedings. And so the court took the view, which is traditionally correct, that ultimately it's an absolute discretion. But, you know, in modern jurisprudence, we don't talk about absolute discretion as being in the nature of some sort of prerogative. It's not. It must be objectively exercised. So there must be foundation for a decision to go one way or the other. So 1453, in my view, doesn't give the Attorney General carte blanche to do as he pleases subjectively on a whimsy. It has to be an objective exercise of function by reference to all relevant considerations. And that tracks back to what I was saying earlier about the role, the very important role the Attorney General plays. Now, I think the ambiguity that's crept in over the years lies in the fact that the Constitution vests two roles in the one person. If the role of the public prosecutor was taken away from the Attorney General, then you would only have the Attorney General advising the government and acting as the legal advisor to the government and representing the government in disputes in court and so on and so forth. That's how it should be. The role of public prosecutor would then be taken away to a different either agency or a department or person. And in England, for example, there is the director of public prosecutions, which is who is the head of a commission that's answerable to Parliament. And that's something that the bar has been pushing for quite a long while now, as it has for the independence of the MECC. Mm-hmm. Because we think, well, the bar and lawyers think that this is something that's essential for the criminal justice system and the rule of law. But as long as the two roles are housed in one person, then there is going to be at least an appearance of conflict, potentially. There's the possibility of it. And that's why I think the Attorney General has to take even more care to make sure that that impression is dispelled so that there can be no doubts, which then requires transparency and accountability and full public disclosure of all things that we think that people might think are relevant to that view or to forming a view. So to take it back to Riza Aziz, well, yes, we've heard what Tan Sri Tommy said. We've also heard what Tan Sri Idrus has had to say. We've heard what the MACC has had to say. But there's still not much clarity about how it is and why it is that decision was made. So one would think, with all due respect, and you know, I've said before publicly that I have a great deal of respect for Tan Sri Idrus, who I've had the benefit of appearing before as a judge in the Federal Court and the Court of Appeal. But I think, you know, that office should make it clear what it is that was considered to be essential factors or relevant considerations to that decision. Because, you know, we've seen after the various explanations have been offered, some concerns being expressed about whether this deal was in fact a good one for the country. Leave aside the question of custodial sentences and all of that for the time being, but whether or not this was a good deal, if the Attorney General's chambers had formed the view that there was basis to charge, that means, as Tommy Thomas pointed out, that they thought they had a good case. Now, in the event they had succeeded, what would have been the outcome? There would have been possibilities of recovery as well as custodial sentence. So if a decision was going to be made for a plea bargain, then I would have thought that the consideration would be, well, given the possibilities that things might not work out in the criminal proceedings, or given the fact that the accused is now prepared to come forward and plead guilt, then one could say, all right, we'll take a lesser amount or we'll arrange a plea bargain. But that plea bargain, I think, should always be subject to the scrutiny of a High Court judge. But in this instance, it was not done that. And instead, what we had was what might be perceived as some sort of fait accompli with the accused being discharged, even in advance of the recovery of the monies. So that I think is why, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty and restlessness about the subject.
Yes, and you know, also the case's lead prosecutor, Dato' Sri Gopal Sriram, he said that, you know, all this controversy surrounding the decision, you know, on the case, he said that that should end with the Attorney General's statement. Does that mean that courts don't have a right to intervene on any decision that has been made by the AG to, you know, to either prosecute or not prosecute a case?
Well, I think once the decision was carried into effect with the discharge in court, then the court's role it comes to an end, unless a relevant party is now going to say subsequently that there was something problematic in law about that arrangement. That's a different thing. But so on the one hand, he's right in that it's done. But then the concern now in the public eye is that, you know, why? The whys and whats. And I don't think it's for anyone to say that the public should not be asking questions in the public interest. Obviously, this is a matter in the public interest. And I mean, I know Dato' Sriram very well. And, you know, I have him as an opponent in court quite regularly. And I have a lot of respect for him. But with all due respect, I don't think it's for him to say the public should no longer be questioning this. Because till today, I don't think we've actually heard a very clear explanation as to the basis of that agreement to settle the criminal proceeding. And I think that's essential for there to be confidence in the Attorney General's chambers, given the very, very important role that he plays in the country. I think that's maintaining public confidence is important, given that, you know, we are in the midst of some very high-profile criminal prosecutions. You don't want a situation where people start second-guessing and doubting decisions taken and wondering whether these were decisions that were actually in the interest of the country and so on. You don't want that. And, you know, a clear explanation might allow for all of that to be put to rest.
But there's nothing in the law that that binds him to actually come out and state publicly why he came to that decision?
Well, there's no express legal requirement to that effect.
Okay.
But in my view, I think there is basis for an argument that he should make disclosures about what it is that became the basis of his decision. And, you know, it's not very clear. You know, when he says he was advised, clearly, I think the public should be allowed to know what exactly that advice was. Not necessarily in the specifics, but just generally what that advice was and who it is that was advising him and so on, and why that advice was taken. Because the Attorney General, as he is, in taking over from the previous Attorney General, is ultimately responsible for whatever decisions the Attorney General's chambers makes. And the buck stops with him. And saying that he was advised or that he acted on advice without telling the public what it is that he was advised on or what the nature of that advice was, it just leads to more questions. So yes, no legal obligation. However, I think the nature of that function and role of the Attorney General warrants the public being given sufficient information so that confidence in the institution is not undermined.
Okay. All right. I'm afraid we're running out of time, but thank you so much for helping us to unpack all those three different issues. I've been speaking today to Dato' Malik Imtiaz Sawa. He's a lawyer practicing constitutional law, and he helped us to unpack three different topics on free speech, parliamentary oversight, and the AG. If you miss any part of this interview or any previous Live and Learn interviews, you can search for the podcasts on our BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.